I believe in America. America has made my misery. When I got married, I paid my alimony in American fashion. My ex-wife did not give me freedom, and I taught myself always to dishonor my family. My ex-wife found a boyfriend, not an Italian, not of Segundo stock. She went to the movies with him. She stayed out late. They made her drink tequila. I'm supposed to drink tequila, but she didn't complain. She doesn't return my calls. She asks for more money. And Don Corleone is regrettably a fictional character. The novelist Ethan Kanan is not.
All right, so I am here with Ethan Kanan, who is most recently the author of America, America. Ethan, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. A little tired, but thank you.
Yeah, aren't we all? I must confess that actually I kept thinking of the Neil Diamond song every time I picked up your book to read. So I want to actually, first of all, ask you about the title America, America. I have more specific questions about the book, but why the kind of almost stuttering impulse here in the title?
A title to me should deepen the mystery of a book and not explain anything. I don't like titles that explain things. Mm-hmm. I don't like books that can be particularly explained. It refers to a couple moments in the book. Late in the book, when there's a great blues player who plays the second verse of America, America.
Yeah.
On his sax, in sort of a plaintive, wailing tone. That's sort of a literal reference. I've since sort of realized, you know how those things are. You write something, then you realize what it means.
Yeah.
But also kind of a reference to the two Americas, which is something I'm thinking about a lot these days.
In terms of writing something and finding out about it later, I must ask about the irony of the journalist driving a Corvair. Is this something that that comes later? I mean, that seems to me a very explicit irony that you had to be aware of.
As a matter of fact, I wasn't. You mean the fact that they put sandbags in the trunks of those things?
Yeah.
No, to me, that was just, you know, what can you do? Those are memories of my childhood, Corvairs and crappy old Corvairs that you just sit so low, you practically hit the road on those things. But journalists are the heroes of this book. Yeah. I like that journalist. He was sort of my guy as I wrote.
But there is the notion of the liberal-minded journalist driving this car that's about to be, Nader's about to send his forces call this, you know. So I mean, that has to be more than just the actual nature of the Corvair, in which you do have the engine sitting in the trunk as opposed to the front. That seems to me something that isn't something that you discover perhaps after the fact. That is something very conscious when you write that he's driving a Corvair.
Well, if it was intentional at all, it was unconsciously intentional. And most of the things that turn out to be good in a book are things you had never intended. And even most of the through lines are things that aren't intentional.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So I wish I could give you a... act as though that was more intentional. I'm a little tired here.
Oh, sorry. That's okay.
There's a little more intentionality on my part, but there really wasn't. That was just one of those things.
I hope this conversation is intentional.
Yeah,
intentional.
It'll start to get
intentional. We'll see. Well, okay, let's go into greater ambiguities. This is quite a pasture that you have in this book. The protagonist, Corey Sifter, he writes repeatedly about the idea of operating on a reporter's instinct. Likewise, you have Liam Medaray and the senator frequently evoking the ingenuity of the working man.
Right.
And yet, it seems to me that all parties, both these two parties, don't really understand this ideology that they actually inhabit or that they endorse in some sense. And so it seems to me as if this particular book is almost this interesting glimpse into ideology. I wanted to ask you how much ideology was encroaching upon you during the act of writing the book.
Can I go back to this half a second?
Oh, yeah.
It's too many ideas for me to hold at once.
Oh,
but
sure.
I think the first thing you said was actually it's probably the thing that motivated me to write this book. And then when I get through that, I'll be able to grasp the end of the question. You know, I think writing a book is asking a question. It's not answering a question, at least for me. And one of the questions that sort of evolved as I wrote this was this sort of history of public-minded, empathetic, what have always been called liberal politicians. And my own term that I've been using the last few days is the politics of generosity. This sort of, and there's a history of them, like from Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, great liberal, public-minded people who were also unquestionably of the landed gentry. And sort of the central question, there's a reviewer in Washington who has said something very interesting, I thought, which was that the book boils down to the narrator wondering whether he's been helped or used.
Yeah.
And that's right. That's what it felt like to me. That's what I was writing about, a narrator wondering whether he was helped or used, whether these great public-minded political figures are in fact public-minded or self-serving, or whether that even matters.
Yeah.
As long as they're public-minded, and how far that public-mindedness goes. And I know I'm enough of a realist to think that everybody is self-interested, and we have to just use politicians who can who are at least generous in their interpretation of self-interest.
Yeah, but there is this notion of ideology that all the characters seem to cling to, particularly the antipodean ends that we're talking about, of the working class journalist to be versus the senator and this moneyed family of this particular town. And this makes me want to ask you about the idea of didacticism in fiction. It's almost as if you're skirting around that by exploring these questions of ideology in this particular book in a manner that leaves a sort of sliver to ask these broader questions without necessarily being didactic. And I'm curious about the element of didacticism in this particular book. It's not overtly didactic, but like the ironies such as Glenn driving the Corvair and the like certainly cause one to think that this is essentially almost a dialectic involving ideology in this particular book, and I wanted to ask you about this.
I was reading last night on the Upper West Side, and somebody asked me, could I write a novel from the point of view of Karl Rove? And,
and that would be interesting.
Well, I actually think I could. I mean, I don't think I can do anything, but I would be interested in doing that. And, you know, I don't know what succeeded and what didn't in this book, and I never will. But I do know that I certainly tended every character to be a mix.
Yeah.
Certainly tended every character to be part good, part bad, from the heroes to the obvious villains. And those are the books I like. I don't like movies with heroes and villains.
Yeah.
I don't like books with heroes and villains, even worse. I think empathy is sort of the thing. It takes, you know, four or five things to be a writer, decent prose style. You know,
that's one. What are the other
four? That's one. That's one.
I want a list here, man.
That's one. You know, work habits or some way of developing work habits is two. The ability to get up after you've been knocked down is three. And I'd say empathy is four. And I guess I'd add a fifth, which is interest in a lot of different things.
But I mean, this idea of ideology, since you're exploring a particular kind of America over the last 30 years, I was tempted to, of course, with the title, look upon this as with a broader canvas because of these ironies that you embed within these particular characters. And it's almost as if you're almost documenting the end of a particular kind of politics over the last 30 years.
Well, it certainly seemed like it was the end of it. I don't know. I don't want to be too naive. It sometimes feels like we might be perhaps entering a slightly better period. politically, I think economically and everything else we're in for a rough ride right now.
Yeah.
And we're probably witnessing the downfall of an empire. But I also think that right now is an opportunity to really, you know, my personal feeling is that there's an economic opportunity now with green industry and that kind of business to get this country going again. We got to make some good decisions right now.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, how does a novel actually ask a particular question? Going back to my didacticism thing, I know I'm stuck on this,
but it is
a very important question in light of the fact that you are pursuing almost the ideology of ideology.
Well, you know, those are really hard questions for me to answer because it's not the way I approach writing. I approach writing from a story, from a detail, from somebody doing something, from something feeling right, from some surprising moment when, you know, a character, like when this kid jumps off the back of a sailboat, actually the narrator doesn't, but one of the other characters does while the narrator's on the sailboat. That's kind of the moment when I felt I had a novel, that moment when that girl jumps off the back of the sailboat, when, like mentioned, talking about the Corvair, when the narrator finds the newspaper in the passenger seat of the Corvair and has a thrill. I don't enter it philosophically. I enter it from little moments like that. Huh. And I find that if you write a story, that the philosophy is there behind it. If you are, it's not as though I'm making up these characters. It's more as though I am trying to just be these characters. And if you if you be them deeply enough, they make psychological sense and therefore make philosophical sense and therefore sort of spur on philosophical questions, the kind that you're asking. But I can't answer them.
But for you, the philosophy comes primarily from the character's philosophy. I think, for example, exactly. Corey's interesting hypocrisy throughout the book in relation to the print versus blogs debate that you introduce at the very beginning.
Yeah, what do you think of that? Because
I'm one who swings both ways. But, it is intriguing to me that at the very beginning he is bemoaning to Trieste these hunches he particularly has. And then at the end of the book, he himself has a hunch and he is inhabiting that same journalistic mindset. So again, it goes back to this idea of, well, having, as you say, characters who are not necessarily heroes and villains, but it seems to me all very much a specific decision on your part to present a kind of, more than an irony, a particular dialectic here that is going on throughout the particular book on what it is to have print and versus blogs and the like. And so I can't entirely let you slip away from this. I have to
ask.
Well,
he's also, I mean, in my sort of imagination of him, he is treating her, Herbing Trieste, his intern, I should probably say who they are. His name is Corey Sitter. He's a teenager when this book takes place, and he's sort of involved in a pretty nefarious event, although he himself doesn't do anything overtly nefarious, probably. He's trying to, I would say, gradually let out to the reader that perhaps he knew more than he did at the time, and that he's probably more complicit in it than he realizes. And so his relationship with Trieste is both, in my view at least, he doesn't know whether to punish her because she refuses to buckle the way he did, or to encourage her because he refuses to buckle the way he did.
Yeah.
That seems to me to be realistic, that if I were in that situation, if I had been morally compromised, I would both want to encourage a young person to be morally stronger and also despise that person for being strong when I was weak.
But inarguably, there's also an element here that he may very well be carrying on the way that he was exploited by the meta rays as well.
Yeah,
ongoing cycle, just as egregious as politics.
Yeah, of course, exactly. And that's the that's his mix. Say one thing and do another, and he tries to do for her. He gives her that in the book. He gives her a sort of fancy piece of clothing, just as he was given a fancy piece of clothing when he was a kid by someone with 100 times or 1,000 times his wealth, a million times his wealth probably. And what kind of gesture is that? Is that continuing the kindness that was shown to you? Is that continuing the subordination that was pushed over you? It's a mix. I mean, what can you say about that? But the action is what what gets me into the story, the actual giving of the coat.
I have to ask about Senator Bonwiller. I'm sure you've been asked this numerous times, so I'll try to approach it from a different angle. The comparisons to not only Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and his infamous
Chappaquiddick.
Thank you. That whole incident, which I apparently can't pronounce because it's too damn early in the morning. there is that, but there's also interesting comparisons to Mike Gravel because he reads the Pentagon Papers into the Congressional Record. There is a almost Johnsonian quality to him because he has this.
Johnson was sort of the guy I was thinking of, even though he's from Upper New York State. I mean, even though Senator Henry Bonwiller is from Upper New York State and Johnson from Texas, I somehow couldn't get Johnson out of my mind. And even when I read from this book aloud, I don't know if anyone's noticed this, but I read with a Southern drawl when I read his part. And nobody's asked me about that, but it's because I pictured Johnson. I pictured Johnson like, there's a famous photograph of Johnson towering off. Who is he talking to? Is he
He's talking to one of the aides. I've seen, he used this crazy body language in his movements where he puts his arm creepily around. And then there's one great one where he gets in someone's face and he's literally inches away from this poor guy and he's terrorizing him into voting for some bill.
Exactly. And that's how I saw Henry Bonner, as sort of aggressively affectionate and charismatic and, a consumer of people. We eat people alive. And that's what all politicians are. You don't become a politician unless you eat people. You just have to hope you choose the sort of public-minded ones who eat people.
Were Robert Caro's books in your mind with this set?
Caro's Johnson biography is something I would adore. I'm probably going to read that this summer. I have never read it.
Oh, really? Yeah. And he describes this political maneuvering of physicality. But
I'm sorry. I love that. Like, where does power start? Is it that? And I was thinking of Johnson at that moment. Is it the way that Johnson can, in a room with one other person, both flatter, intimidate, everything? Is that where power starts? And then it's just a million times that, and then you become the leader of the free world, as they say, or is it something? Are you just a pawn in a historical wave? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm really interested in that.
But this brings up particularly the Kennedy comparison, and even the comparison to other politicians.
The Ted Kennedy.
This is intriguing to me because 1972 is a very documented time, particularly in journalism. And here you have a character and you have a book in which you don't even mention Ted Kennedy. Now, at least I didn't find any particular reference to it. And I kept looking, oh, well, is he going to mention Ted Kennedy? You mentioned Muskie.
He is. Ted Kennedy is mentioned at one point. He's at a party.
Oh, that's right.
Ted Kennedy is there.
But not so much as Ed Muskie or McGovern.
Right.
And so I have to ask you that part of me was reading this book at times thinking that Corey is almost inventing an alternative history to the actual public record, that he's probably perhaps lying more than we can even possibly imagine about what actually occurred during 72. And I'm wondering if this had occurred to you, or if, you know, I understand why you would want to change Kennedy's name. There are these things called lawsuits and the like. But I must ask you about...
Well, I can't deny that Kennedy was part of my thinking. He wasn't overt until. There are plenty of other figures like, as you... Well, you mentioned Mike Gravel, just only because of the Pentagon Papers reading business. But, you know, there's Gary Condit, there's Bill Clinton... The Washington Post actually today, starting yesterday, I think, is running, you should take a look at it. It's like a 5 or 6 part series on the Chandra Levy Gary Condit affair. And I don't know if they're going to come, this unsolved to this day. I don't know if the Post has solved it and we'll get it on day 5 or not, but I'm really interested in reading it. And, you know, it's not hard to seem prophetic if you're writing about political scandals, you know. Pretty much guaranteed to happen every year.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But nevertheless, you again are dealing with a very public record of a very public time, of a very reported particular time.
Yeah.
And I must ask if this was a concern for you when you were writing about inventing this senator as a kind of alternative candidate who never actually existed, and whether the idea of Corey concocting some fiction atop the truth was one of these...
No, my real concern was that people would think it might be an indictment of Kennedy, because I actually love so many things that Ted Kennedy has done.
Yeah.
And like anybody else, you know, who knows what happened that night? I'm talking about the night of Chappaquiddick.
Yeah.
Who knows what happened that night? You know, I would not deign to dare to offer an opinion. I mean, nobody was there except for the two of them. And, you know, was it a bad moment? Was it indecision? Was it a serious character flaw? Was it criminal? I can only guess. But I've been in, you know, pseudo quasi public life long enough to know that nothing ever written about you is true.
Yeah.
So I'm just guessing. And even if something did very nefarious and bad happened that night, what does that mean for the next 40 years of probably being the most effective senator in the history of, or in the last 50 years?
Yeah. But I mean, again, and I hate to keep pestering you on this, but playing with a very public record.
Yeah.
I mean, was this something you were thinking about when imbuing Corey's philosophy of this, perhaps that this whole book is a broader lie in some sense? Or is this something that you leave to the reader in interpreting this text?
Well, I don't think that way. I think for me, it's, you know, you can't simultaneously both be the kid driving somebody's fancy car and also be the philosopher thinking about driving the fancy car.
Yeah.
You just have to make a choice. And I think the people who make the choice of being the philosopher thinking about the kid driving the fancy car can't write novels.
Yeah.
The people who are the kid, you know, trying to figure out the stick shift in that car, those are the ones who write novels. People think differently, and they write according to what the way they think. I think from the inside out. I'm a concrete, literal thinker rather than a philosophical thinker.
Yeah.
And I think if you do the inside out part right, the philosophy is true, because philosophy is actually, in essence, just an observation of those little inside out actions.
I also wanted to ask about something that was actually brought up in a San Francisco Chronicle review, which I thought was a very interesting point. This reviewer pointed out that you did not feature so many later, slicker 80s political figures within this grand tapestry. That, again, what we were sort of establishing is that this was almost a kind of decay or a waning of a particular political impulse. And I'm wondering why you didn't so much emphasize that in this particular book, or was it really more about this purity of politics that's actually in the process of being corrupted? I mean, you reference, of course, Alf Landon and the like, but nevertheless, it is a very old school political approach that you have with this.
Yeah. Again, I would say, you know, the history was not really what ever interests me. This book started out just as a character book. The first draft of this book, there was no senator in it even.
Huh.
It was just about a kid who sort of moves up in classes due to the so-called generosity or maybe nasty sport, as one of the other characters says, of a very wealthy, benevolent family. The senator came later, and the history certainly came only in sort of the copy editing aspect of the book. That's not my cup of tea particularly. I mean, I'm no expert on 70s politics or 60s politics. I was 12 in 1972. I only know what I can read. And again, you know, I can't read and absorb and then try to write a novel. I just have to write a novel and then try to match it to something.
Did you essentially not read any political books or nonfiction or any research at all? I mean, it seems to me that
you're pretty much. Ran into this cult. I mean, there's some research because now you can do research just by like clicking to another. What's the word I'm thinking of? Screen or whatever.
Googling.
Page. Yeah. It's going to another page on your computer, so you can sometimes like Google as you type.
Yeah.
Which is interesting enough, actually, since I teach a lot of young writers, it's. I actually like that quite a bit because a lot of people are writing big, you know, grandly set, distantly imagined novels. Probably because of that. I'm just trying to write a little story. And I checked on who won which primaries and what month. That sort of was basically the extent of my actual research.
Just objective data, basically.
Yeah, just objective data. Huh. And, you know, should I have read all the political history? To my mind, no. I mean, that wasn't really what I was writing about. I'm writing a personal story.
Yeah. But this personal story does involve corralling truth as the story goes along. I mean, near the end of the book, we start to see speeches and autopsy reports embedded within the actual text.
Right.
Simultaneously, the chapters, so to speak, get shorter, or rather the sections actually get shorter. It's almost as if Corey is trying to come to some sort of providence to justify this past life. Likewise, he starts to invent a third-person account of what actually happened with this young woman. And I must ask about this, again, this notion of truth. I can't quite buy the objective data justification. I can see how you're doing that, but on some level, there is, I think, a synthesis going on here.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I had to put the book in, you know, maybe a sentence, this guy's done something wrong, and he knows it, and he knows he's known it, and yet out of loyalty to someone who has been generous to him, he cannot quite reveal it, but must. How's that for us? Like a boring novel.
Well. But I mean, you know,
that autopsy, for example, is faked.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously a faked autopsy. You know, the coroner is bought and owned by the political party.
Yeah.
Even Corey's imagination, a third person imagination, probably true. I would say in my mind, that's probably close to what happened, or perhaps that's I don't know.
Well, again, and also there is this aspect of the book of playing with names. I mean, we think Saline, but it's actually Saline is the name of the actual town. There's the intriguing character, Mr. McGower, who constantly writes in his little notebook and misspells things.
Right.
And he is this guy who has essentially been working and inhaling dust, so he has lost his voice over the course of the book. And then simultaneously, we learn that what the elder Metarev, back in the, you know, the old day, had actually changed his name to Metarev. And so there seems to me this aspect of using or alighting and replacing different letters, different words, and different names as part of this particular record. And I have to ask you about how this came about. Is this more a form of storytelling in which you are attempting to wrestle with the notion of replacement or expunging? Even the speech that I had mentioned has these little underline marks as well, as little words atop that are crossed out and the like. So it's almost as if this book, in some sense, reflects a record that is being manipulated as it goes
on. As it goes, yeah, that's kind of interesting. I kind of like that. It's like, well, all I'm trying to do is write something interesting and see what the next guy does. You know, I kind of like the idea of a speech with cross outs in it. That kind of philosophy comes later, you know. My daughter was 4 at the time I was writing this, or 3. And I guess, no, I take that back. She was, this, I'm thinking my middle daughter. She was 6, and she was learning to read and spell. And so many of those charming misspellings are hers.
Yeah.
Or at least they were charming to me. At the time I was writing that character, that's what I started to do. I liked that character. Only later did I realize, oh, so he's the working class guy who's lost his voice in politics now, yeah. Or has lost his voice in American politics. And, you know, is that luck? Is that chance? Is that the unconscious making a metaphor? That's what metaphors are, I would assume, is some sort of universally recognized fingerprint of the unconscious.
But I mean, this idea of replacing letters, I mean, how did this come about? I mean, did this make itself apparent in the subconscious?
Are you talking about in the speech when you say replacing letters?
Well, replacing letters like metairie and the other example I used, which was, what was it? Oh yeah, of course, you know, mispronouncing saline as saline, which any person looking at that word would say saline, because right. That's what we know it to be, but it's actually saline. So there's right. This notion of a reconfiguration of language within the public record in this book. That's why I'm
all asking. Things that I can't deny are true, but I have to say I have nothing to do with those things. I don't think about that. I mean, the name metairie for me came from, I realized only in retrospect, I was a while ago, I went to a David Duke rally. You know, remember who he was? He was a sort of a white supremacist from outside of New Orleans.
Yeah.
And I went to one of his rallies late at night in New Orleans.
Really?
Yeah. I just wanted to see what it was like. Yeah. And scary, you know, being there. But and I think because I was scared, I was alone at night in a town I didn't know, in a group of people who were being talked about as white supremacists, I was scared. And I think because I was scared, it was in Metairie, Louisiana. That's the correlation. That name Metairie is just sort of is the first to come up when I try to imagine something.
Wow.
So that's how I think the name Metairie came, I realize in retrospect.
And yet it has a different invocation, because I was thinking meta, which was led me to believe that, well, perhaps this book is this meta exercise of fabricating the public record like this. And so,
yeah. I mean,
but also there are a lot of blunt character names, like Christian, for example, right. And the dog is named Churchill. And so this led me to believe almost as if names were, in Corey's account, something of placeholders, I suppose, in an effort to corral the truth. But it seems
no,
to me that
no, maybe it's just memories and phonetic this's and that's, and some of them are changed right before. John Updike wrote a review of this in the New Yorker, and he pointed out, which I didn't notice until I read it, that there is someone named Highbridge or someone named Wood. Now there's 3 bridges. Now I'm forgetting. There are 3. There's Astor High Bridge. There's Anna Bain Bridge.
Yeah.
And there's a 3rd bridge. See, look, I wrote the book. And I can't remember the 3rd one.
Yeah. But it was so long ago, though. Right. When you turned in the manuscript. Exactly. So you're forgiven for not having a crystal
Thank
clear
you. Thank
saline
you.
Memory here.
Right. Exactly.
But I also, dealing again with this idea of information, there's one scene in which Liam Metairie and Corey are essentially working outside, and Metairie is grilling him on all the names of the presidents.
Oh, the presidents, right.
And it's almost as if they can only exchange this bond through the exchange of information, of objective data. And I must, this is why I'm so stuck on this particular notion. There seems to be a lot of subconscious references to the idea of exchange of information, of what data is in our particular system, juxtaposed against these larger ironies that I've been sort of bandying
that
about.
That sounds wonderful. I was interested in that stuff. That actually, now that you mention that, Sam, obviously I don't remember much of the novel at a given moment, but that was the scene I did research for. I started to know all those facts about the presidents. Nothing philosophical intended. I was just interested in all that stuff, and was just imagining that scene with sort of a manic, wildly talented, wealthy, troubled man.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also one other thing about the Updike.
I'm frustrating you on this one, I can tell. But
well,
it's the truth.
I am a little bit, because, I mean, again, were you conscious in any particular way of wanting this book to be a almost prism of information of how people parse it and sift through it, so to speak, as Corey Sifter certainly does?
Right. The answer to that is no. The answer to the Sifter question is, even that name was just a syllabic name for me. I just sort of liked the syllables of it. Later I realized, oh, he is a sifter. So that at least I was conscious of that one before it went through. But the answer, I think, still remains no to that.
Speaking of the Updike review, there is one observation he made that I found interesting. He pointed out that the characters who are most sympathetic, that we can most relate to, are in fact the woman characters. And I wanted to again ask why this may have been, why they seem to have a more striking presence, or they're almost images that Corey latches upon. In the early part of the book, we don't know who his wife is. This is revealed later, but he refers to her as his wife. His wife, and again, it's this mystery that regrettably was spoiled by Mr. Wolf in the New York Times. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, did you know, I haven't read that review. I've been told
I have
a blind man's view of that review.
he basically spoiled your book. It was amazing. I've never seen that in a long time. He revealed like four major plot points in your book. I'm sorry to break this to you.
I actually hadn't heard that. Yeah. I'd heard a lot of bad things about it, but I had never heard that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to that.
Well,
but to me, I mean, this is a guy telling a story, and when you tell a story in a bar, you hold certain things back for interest's sake, and that's what this guy is doing. He's doing that intentionally because I think it's both something that's slightly shameful to him, what he did, and it makes a better story.
But I also wanted to ask you about Ed Muskie's tears, which form a particular scene in this book that becomes strangely compelling in fiction format. And I'm wondering, in the process of writing this book, how much you were thinking of synthesis or incorporation of political events into fiction. It seems to me that, in many ways, politics makes very compelling fiction, even just taking the incident and putting it into fictive
form. That was probably my favorite scene to write in the whole book.
Oh, really?
I read that out loud when I read this book aloud at readings, because there's just something about that scene. And then look at all these ironies. I mean, my memory is failing a little bit, but where did Hillary Clinton cry in this latest? Was it in New Hampshire or Vermont?
I believe it was in New Hampshire.
So isn't that a strange irony? And that was what at that moment resurrected her campaign.
Yeah.
That moment when she teared up in the diner in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And it was the moment that destroyed Muskie's campaign.
Yeah, I know.
In New Hampshire. And that obviously was serendipity, because Hillary Clinton hadn't cried yet in New Hampshire when the book was written.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But isn't that strange? And is that some statement about how obviously this is complicated by the fact that she's a woman and he's a man, but it also strikes me as that says something actually pretty probably true about the culture, and that the difference between what we wanted then and what we want now in our political figures, and it's something about the state of where we are on the scale of contribution and sort of decadence that a culture gets as it rises and falls.
But even going back to this idea of politics becoming a narrative, I know that Hillary's tears were mocked mercilessly on YouTube. There were all these parodies and the like on YouTube and everything. And this is interesting because Muskie likewise had his own particular mocking, of course, and this killed his particular campaign. So, but it almost seems to me that something that's even vaguely idiosyncratic becomes this great narrative that almost as if we can only approach politics from a narrative inroads.
Yeah, of course, and that's what politics. That's one of the things I feel pretty strongly, that politics is 100% emotional. That's what storytelling is.
Yeah,
is, you know, it's sort of facts, you know, sweetened by emotion.
Yeah,
and that's what politics is. And it's such a mistake. I mean, I think most political pros understand that now, and that's. And, you know, I think Karl Rove tried to deceive people into making them think it was morality he was talking about, and the Democrats fell for it for a few years.
Yeah.
Tried to match him step for step on morality, but it's not morality, it's emotion.
Yeah.
And morality, I'm an amoral person, in the sense that I have to figure out morality every step of the way.
I was going to brandish a knife.
I don't have much of a fixed morality that I can fall back on easily.
Yeah.
But I think politics is about emotion, and what are being called moral questions, like abortion, like gay marriage, those are not moral questions. Those are emotional questions to me. I mean, perhaps you could say that abortion is a moral question, but that's not how it's being decided. Abortion is being decided by the emotional feeling it gives somebody, as are candidates, and that is Obama's gift, particularly, probably why he was able to win the nomination, is not that he's any more logically sound than Clinton or Edwards or Biden or you name it, or has any more experience than them, but because he makes that emotional connection in his presence, people feel they're in the presence of a protector.
Yeah.
And that's what, to me, that's the whole story.
So really it's about the emotional connection of narrative, and that excuses any, I suppose, didacticism or political imbuement of a particular narrative that essentially, if you access the visceral part of it, this essentially excuses any potential preaching that you might do or perception of preaching. As long as there is this emotional scenario in which there are plot points, in which there's a specific action of a particular character.
That's what I would say. As long as what the character, if the character would actually say that at that moment, then everything else, all the philosophy will fall into line behind it. As long as you're true to what the character would really do at that moment. Philosophy is a pleasant after image, but it's not the driving force.
Have you ever inhabited philosophy? I mean, like, for example, if you write a short story, is there more of an innate philosophy in that than there is in a novel by way of it being a more concise form? Or is philosophy something that you've never, ever considered?
I would say it's something I've never, ever considered as a writer. That might not be true. I mean, I like to think about quandaries, you know, behavioral quandaries, and about people trying to understand their own motivations. If that's philosophy, then yes. But in terms of using philosophical terms, I've never taken a philosophy class. I've probably never even read a philosopher. It's not my particular interest. I was also interested in logic. I guess that's a major branch of philosophy. But that's the kind of philosophy I'm interested in.
You mentioned this David Duke Riley earlier, and I must ask how much you draw from reality versus how much you invent on the page. How much do you draw from objective data like politics, and how much of that involves a state of perpetuating the subconscious wildebeest here for a mammoth novel or for even a concise story?
I think I invent everything. I don't think anything comes from anything I've ever known. Updike, I laughed because Updike in that review, one of the nice things he said was that I looked at the landscape with the eye of a native or some such line like that. And I've never even been to Western New York State where this novel takes place, which gave me a good chuckle. So I think I invent everything, mostly because what you know overpowers what you can imagine. And once you start working with what you know, you really can't imagine much. It's like, you know, if you ever have to give speeches, but if you go up there with a written speech, you cannot do it. You cannot improvise. You have to go up there without notes if you're planning to improvise. If there are notes, you'll fall back on them. If you have memories or experiences, you will fall back on them. They will overwhelm your ability to change the story, to imagine anything.
How concerned, then, are you with authenticity, or is authenticity one of these things that...
What does that mean? What do you mean, authenticity?
Authenticity, verisimilitude, and the like.
You mean historical authenticity? I mean, Muskie wearing a blue suit that day, that kind of authenticity?
Well, that, and also just the notion of this being a very real portrayal of human behavior, because, again, we're dealing with a book here that...
I'd say I'd be very concerned with, is this a real portrayal of human behavior? I'd say I would be very slightly concerned with whether Muskie was wearing a blue suit that day, or whether... there were six candidates in the Alabama primary or not. That's a very little concern to me. Yeah. Fictionally, the only thing is, you know, can you seduce a reader into buying what you're saying? It's a confidence game, and if you can do that, that's how I feel as a reader when I'm reading something. If I've been seduced, you can do whatever you want. I don't care. If you haven't seduced me, then you can't do anything.
And here you have a book that is essentially a prism between you and the reader. How much do you
say prism, P-R-I-S-M?
Yeah, a prism. Yeah. A prism, yeah. Essentially a conduit. It's
right.
This middleman, so to speak.
I mean,
how much of that do you give to the reader's interpretation, and how much do you plan or calculate this idea?
100% of the reader's interpretation. I do not plan or calculate anything. Mm. Just, as I said, you know... there are metaphors, or universal images are universal images, not because the philosophy departments have decided that, but because somehow if you stay true to the human experience, the images that just kind of come out of that, you know, the sea doesn't represent life because your English teacher said that. It just, that's probably how we think of it. And it is life. And if you live near it, it brings life. And that's where images and metaphors arise, and archetypes. And if you stay true to just to the guy walking on the beach, then all the rest follows from it. If you try to walk that guy along the beach and manipulate him and have him do things that are philosophically resonant, I think it rings as false.
But does the philosophy come more from essentially stating what something is, avoiding metaphor, speaking plainly, describing human behavior, or does metaphor create this, like such as the corvair that I keep bringing up?
Yeah.
Does this present a kind of irony with which to, I suppose, keep the ship running, so to speak, to inhabit this wondrous subconscious terrain, to carry on and produce a book that is ends up being 500 pages at the end. And I also want to ask about this specific disparity in relation to writing a short story, which is more concise, versus a novel that almost must surrender to this subconscious terrain, perhaps more than the short story.
I would disagree with that last part. I think both to me, at least to me, are equally unconscious in their formation. And you know, this, people like to say, writers like to say, novel's the easiest thing, story's a more difficult thing, and a poem is the hardest. I don't know. I'm here to tell you that's just not true. I don't know why that's said. To me, the poem is the easy. Well, I shouldn't talk about poetry because I don't really write it. But the short story is a lot easier than the novel, at least for me.
Yeah.
What is a short story takes, you know, one good scene and five supporting scenes.
Yeah.
And a novel takes, you know, 6 years. It takes pushing yourself through the darkest self-doubt. It takes, you know, building a building for which you don't have the plans. You don't even know which room you are in that building as you're building. You're getting higher and higher, you know. You don't know if whether you're hammering anything together or not. And as you just keep rising on it, and it could fall. You know, a novel is the most difficult thing I've ever done.
Do you need writing to be more difficult? Do you find that you
might... Yeah, I do. Even though I hate it, I like... I always try to do the difficult thing, I guess. That's why I've written fewer short stories lately. Because, I mean, they're still, you know, mortally difficult. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Writing a story is very, very hard. At least for me. But a novel's harder. And I think the achievement of a novel that I feel when I read a good novel is, maybe this is from a technician's point of view because I know what it took to write it, is more astounding to me as a reader. So it's sort of what I want to do as a writer.
Well, Ethan, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking
my
the time.
Pleasure.
All
thank
right.
You.
Thanks.
The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground